wish yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. They brought
greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the theme today is Europe, the sick man of the global economy. I also want to provide some updates on some themes we've been following, like the China trade war and so forth. Before we jump into the Europe topic here. Okay, so what are some of the interesting developments that we've been following of the last week? Well, we're seeing now more and more talk about the Federal Reserve, the central bank, slowing or maybe even stopping its interest rate hikes. You know, we've been on an aggressive 3 to 4 hikes, rate hikes of 25 basis points, and that was a quarter, 1%. For the last couple of years, and we have another one coming here next week, which would be the fourth in this year. And the talk has been, another 4 next year and then 3 the following year. Well, if you've been listening to my show or reading my blogs, I've been saying since a year ago that the Fed will not be able to raise interest rates much further after December. And that was kind of contrary to the consensus among economists who forecast the present or the past rather than the future, play it safe, and we're saying, oh yeah, the Fed's going to raise 4 more times in 18 and then 19 and 20. And I've been arguing can't happen. Can't happen because interest rates cannot rise much further without provoking what's called a credit crunch in the U.S., and the economy's already slowing. We're beginning to see the impact of higher rates already, and rates, of course, are only about 3% on the 10-year Treasury bond, a little less now, a little more for the 30-year, and we have the short-term rates rising, but below 2.7, so forth. Okay, so I've been saying that the Fed cannot raise rates and therefore cause the bond rates to go above 3% very much, maybe another 0.25%, 0.5% at the most, without precipitating even a faster contraction. Already we see the housing, all the indicators in the housing market are down, going down. Autos have peaked. And projections are 200,000 or more less auto sales next year. That's because the rates are rising. Borrowing for a car or a house are rising. So the Fed cannot raise its benchmark rate called the federal funds rate, which affects all the other rates. They move in tandem. Much above its current 2.5%. I've been saying 2.75 or 3 at the most. Well, if we get a rate hike here this week coming up, well, then we'll be at 2.75. And all the other bond rates will rise appropriately. I've been saying for some time, go back to my August articles in European Financial Review and World Financial Review, central banks at the end of their ropes, based on my book, and same title, and will the central bank survive to the mid-21st century, produced in the World Financial Review. They're on my blog, jackrasmus.com. And then, once again, earlier this year in February, in the European Financial Review, an article, Yellen's Legacy, Powell's Dilemma, where I've also kept reiterating, and in my blog post in the early part of this year, that the rates cannot go beyond December 2.7530. Now, that's in contrast to the Fed raising rates in 2007-08 to 5.25%, raising the federal funds rate. That precipitated the Great Recession. Didn't cause it, precipitated it. And I predicted the Fed would do the same thing, would raise rates too far, too high. But the rates could only go now 3%, maybe, the federal funds rate. Maybe 3%. Why? Because we have a much higher debt overhang in the economy. Corporate bond buying has been accelerating for 10 years here. Trillions of dollars added to corporate bonds, especially junk bonds and junk loans, which will be the focus of the next crisis, in part, at record levels. Households, debt at record levels, financing consumption because there's been no real wage increases. Government debt, federal government debt and state debt at record levels. Perhaps more than $20 trillion in debt in the U.S. alone has been added since the last crisis. Okay, that debt overhang makes borrowers, spenders, households, whatever, more fragile to further rate hikes. It can't happen. Because they're financing, they're paying for all this other debt. So if you raise the cost of that other debt, well, they got even less income to spend to generate economic growth. All right, so that was the basis of my analysis why the Fed cannot raise rates beyond 3% federal funds rate, and other interest rates cannot go much higher. Well, they're at the end of that rope. We might get one more rate hike by the Fed in March, but I wouldn't bet on it. And now, finally, the mainstream economists and business press is coming around to the fact, oh, well, you know, maybe the Fed won't be able to raise seven more times in 2019 and 20. And as you know from the show, I've been predicting recession in this country late 2019. Some other economists now are beginning to predict recession in 2020, coming around to the view. And we're getting respected bank research arms, I think it was Morgan Stanley and a couple others who were saying, uh-oh, recession risk is rising 40-50%. You know, even bets here. Okay, so the Fed rate hikes cannot continue. Why is it slowing now? Well, is it because that Trump is attacking the Fed and the chair, Powell? No, that's not the reason. It's because of the global economy slowing down and signs of the U.S. economy slowing down. Europe's growth, GDP, last quarter, third quarter, was only 0.2% growth rate. Stagnant, statistically stagnant, no growth. And it's running into a bunch of problems over there in Europe. We'll get to that Europe sick man, right? All right, where we're seeing Italian banks and debt coming to a head here as a source of crisis and therefore slowdown. Right? We got the Brexit thing in the UK, which is going to continue to fester or worse. We have problems with German banks, Deutsche Bank, Commerce Bank, problems with Swiss banks. And, of course, now we got this eruption in France. Mass street protests called the Yellow Vests, because the protesters wear these yellow vests. And that's against the policies of the French government, which, as we'll describe here, are really representative of policies across Europe of squeezing wages in the working class. And now it's erupting. And we'll see more of this, not just in France, but elsewhere, as the European economy slows, because it's never really recovered very much, you see. Last year was the best year in Europe, barely 2%. Now that's gone. The recoveries are short and shallow. And it's been that way ever since the 2008-09 crash. And Europe's second double-dip recession, which was even worse, of 2011-13. The recovery is short and shallow. That's a classic condition of what I've called epic recessions. You get these big financial crashes like 2008-09, and you get austerity spending and a reliance on monetary policy, and you get a weak recovery, a short, shallow recovery. The periods of recovery are very short-lived and not very robust. So they're followed again by stagnation or another recession. That's Europe. That's also Japan. In the U.S., the epic recession has been dampened by the fact that the U.S. is the global economic hegemon and has exported its slowdown elsewhere. So we get the poor recovery of 1% to 1.5% under Obama instead of recession. Although I believe we had a very mild double dip recession in 2012, in the winter of 2012. And it's only obfuscated by the fact that the Labor Department and the Commerce Department changed the definition of content that goes into GDP, which boosted GDP by 3 to 4 tenths of percentages. And that sort of covered up the fact that we had a very short, shallow recession in the winter of 2012. Looks like we just sort of stopped growing or grew at maybe 1 or 2 tenths percent. Well, if you take away those fake adjustments, and I've talked about them before, in defining GDP in the U.S., then you get a double dip, U.S. double dip in 2012-13. That corresponded to the Europe's double dip recession, which was much worse. And we got very poor recovery after that. And then Trump comes along in response to that. And what does he do? Well, he gets a bit of a boost in U.S. GDP in 2017-18. Why? Well, massive, massive tax cuts for investors, part of which they spent on investing, the vast majority of which they invested offshore and in financial asset markets, and that's why we got booming stock markets. Stock buybacks and all that stuff, you know, over $1 trillion a year for 7 years, and $1.5 trillion maybe in 2017-18 under Trump. Well, some of that trickled down into real investment that gave the economy a little bit of a boost, but that's all wearing off now. You know, you look at gross private domestic investment, real investment in buildings and structures, equipment and so forth, that's dramatically slowing inventories. That's all slowing now. So that Trump bump through the massive tax cut is dissipating. And it's going to dissipate further in 2019. You know, it shows, if you look at 2008 to the present, it shows that capitalism is really in trouble economically, longer term, intermediate term, because it's not generating the economic growth. At least capitalism in the advanced economies, U.S., Japan, and Europe. And they're having to subsidize it now at a rate that's never occurred before. The massive subsidization under Obama was through monetary policy, free money, and trillions of dollars of injected liquidity by the central bank. That's how they financed the subsidization under Obama. Well, that came to an end because it couldn't be sustained. And Trump comes in and he just shifts the subsidization to corporate business tax cuts. investor tax cuts. That's all. They need just to switch the means for subsidization. You know, $4 to $5 trillion in tax cuts to investors and businesses. That was Trump's tax cut earlier this year, $4 to $5 trillion, offset by a couple trillion increase in taxes on us. That $4 to $5 trillion, of course, is over a decade. You know, $1.5 to $2 trillion increase in taxes on the middle class here, which cleverly did not hit the first year. They backdated it to get through the midterm elections, you see. But now it's going to start hitting, and by 2025, it's going to hit real hard. They're going to make up for everything they've given the corporations and businesses by really taking it away from the middle class and households. That was the Trump tax cut. That was the whole strategy, you see. But it's created massive, massive deficits, over $1 trillion a year, and more coming. And I'll talk about government revenues here for the first 2 months of fiscal 2019. The fiscal year begins in October in the U.S. I'll talk about that some more here shortly. But basically, you know, we're running $300 billion deficit. $300 billion deficit in the first 2 months. That's $150 billion a year. If you annualize it, if it continues at that rate, we got $1.5 trillion U.S. federal government deficit coming in 2019. Well, that means we're going to have to reduce spending if they want to get that under control. If they don't, what you're facing is the Federal Reserve having to sell even more bonds in order to pay for this deficit of $1 trillion at higher interest rates. As I said before on the show, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the interest on the debt, repaying the debt from these deficits, $1 trillion a year plus for a decade coming, will be $900 billion by 2028 a year. $900 billion just interest on the debt. Oh, Trump is, by the way, asked for a further increase in war defense Pentagon spending this coming year. A further increase to $750 billion. Well, that's going to add to the deficit and the debt, which means watch next year, they're really going to go after Social Security, Medicare, and education. That's what McConnell wants. We'll see if the Democrats hold firm in the House and prevent that. If they do, the crisis will grow even further because it will be evident that the U.S. cannot pay this massive debt that it has overhanging the federal government. $21 trillion going to $33 trillion by 2028. Well, the Fed now is facing the prospect that there's a global slowdown and recession, global recession, slowly. It's a slow train wreck moving throughout the global economy. Europe is stagnant and, of course, will fall now as the crisis intensifies in Europe in terms of Brexit. We'll talk about that. In terms of France and the Yellow Vest protests. In terms of Italy, populist government refusing to go by Eurozone rules. Other problems in banks throughout Europe. Well, Europe is slowing. Japan's already in recession again. Emerging markets have not recovered from their recession. And as global oil and commodity prices continue to fall, which they will, more and more emerging markets dependent on those sales will stagnate and slip into recession. And, of course, the sick men of emerging markets, Argentina, Brazil, Turkey, and increasingly South Africa, Indonesia, and so forth, excuse me, they're still in recession. they've had to raise their interest rates to 10, 20, 30% or more. Argentina, I think, is at 40% in order to prevent capital flight flowing out of their countries. Or they've had to borrow from the IMF. The IMF issued its largest loan ever to Argentina, and the IMF will soon run out of money to bail out Pakistan and others that are in a similar situation. Oh, and parenthetically, Trump just decided this past week not to give the IMF any more money to bail out other emerging markets, economies. This is all part of Trump's putting the squeeze on other countries to get them to agree to U.S. economic and political policies, you see. Probably an indirect squeeze on Pakistan here. China is slowing as well. Growth in China, well, officially 6.5, but really closer to 5. And it is slowing. So, you know, the whole picture of the global economy everywhere is this slow train wreck beginning to emerge, which puts a difficult condition on the Fed, U.S. Fed, about raising interest rates. You know, if it raises interest rates further, it slows the U.S. economy, which slows the rest of the global economy. Also, the Fed raising interest rates causes capital flight out of the emerging markets, and U.S. multinational corporations that are doing business in Latin America and elsewhere, when those economies' currencies decline because U.S. rates are rising and the dollar's rising as a result, U.S. multinational corporations' profits take a big hit in emerging markets. So that's another contrary pressure on the Fed, against the Fed raising interest rates further. And then, of course, we have the U.S. economy itself slowing. Construction and housing, all the indicators are slowing. Autos, I said, are going to slow, have peaked and are declining. Bank loans in the U.S. are slowing. They weren't that great. corporate credit is slowing as interest rates rise and the cost of yield, the bond rates rise. The stock market is declining, so issuing stock to finance investment is declining. Profits, which were, because of the Trump bump here, 20-25% profit bottom line boost windfall simply because of the Trump tax cuts. Well, that's going to slow here. Some say profits will increase only single digit next year, if that. So whether it's bond financing or equity financing or interest rates, loan borrowing, all of those are getting tighter. And, of course, we see it reflected in the yield curve we talked about last week. And there are political, what they call, tail risks emerging in the U.S. and abroad. Well, in the U.S., it's Mueller. It's the Mueller indictment that's forthcoming here after the new Congress gets sworn in, probably. We'll see what that is. Big risk for Trump. And, of course, we have the deficits and the debt in the U.S. and government spending, which will probably decline. You see, the big boost to U.S. GDP has been the trickle down from the Trump tax cuts into real investment. Maybe about a quarter or a third of that has gone into real investment. That's moderating now. And government spending on defense and state and local spending. And some inventory. Those are the sources of the U.S. GDP 3-4% growth rate here on some quarters in the U.S. Right? Well, all of those are going to moderate this coming year. U.S. spending, government spending in the first 2 months of the current fiscal year, October, November, up 18%. But U.S. tax revenues and receipts only up 3%. Well, that's why we get and how we get that $305 billion deficit for the first 2 months. So, you know, if Fed raises its interest rates, it slows the economy even further, and therefore the tax revenues and receipts decline even further. So the Fed faces a dilemma, the U.S. Central Bank, right? Does it continue to raise rates, which it must, in order to sell the bonds to cover the deficit? And secondarily, it wants to create as much of a rate cushion that it can, because when the recession hits, it'll cut rates again. Well, they don't have much to cut, you see. But those are the two real reasons why rates are going up. It has nothing to do with inflation. Nothing. Raising rates. Because we don't have inflation greater than 2%. You see, the Fed should be raising rates if inflation rate for goods and services is more than 2%, according to its PCE indicator. Well, it hasn't been 2%. Well, why are they raising rates if it's not above 2%? Well, because they got to finance, they got to pay for the budget deficit and the debt. And they're trying to create a cushion. And as I said, that interest on that debt is going to rise to $900 billion a year at the end of Trump's 10-year, $4 to $5 trillion tax handout to investors. Okay, but Trump is trying to accelerate the slowdown of Fed rate hikes. You know, he's criticizing Powell and the Fed. And, of course, that others are doing that as well, behind the scenes. It's not Trump putting pressure on the Fed. It's business putting pressure on the Fed to slow. You know, there's a myth called central bank independence. Oh, that the central bank is independent and should remain independent of politicians. In other words, we have these 14 guys. Well, there's a few women there, too. Seven governors who are unelected. They're appointed by Congress and the president. And they're closely vetted before they get their appointment to be pro-banker. So we get these unelected people indirectly appointed, vetted, and nominated only if bankers agree to it, influencing the entire economy. It's so undemocratic. It's a violation of popular sovereignty. The members of the Fed should not be appointed. They should be elected as well. Well, the Fed should be democratized. All central banks should be democratized so that they are responsive to the general economy and everybody in the economy, not just the bankers and businesses. Well, in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, last year, I concluded with a chapter, postscript, describing how the Fed, the central bank, could and should be democratized, should be part of a public banking system and a public investment corporation whose accountability would be to the entire country. And until you democratize the Fed, the central bank, they will continue to be the handmaiden of bankers, which they are indirectly, very cleverly, opaquely. It's not Trump and presidents that intervene with Fed policy. It's the bankers who run the show and have run the show in the central bank, the Fed, since 1913. At first, from 1913 to 35, very directly, no talk and, you know, argument about central bank independence. They were dependent on the banks. They were run by the banks. And they accepted that. Well, they screwed up during the Depression, and some minor reforms were introduced. Seven public governors, you know, nominated by the president, were introduced. So we had partial reforms in 35, and the bank, the central bank, the Fed, you know, was given a minor role to the Treasury, and but they came. The central bank has come back in the 60s and 70s. And that's when we started hearing talk about, oh, it should be independent, which means that the president should not intervene, but it's okay for the bankers to intervene, which they do behind the scenes, you see. Read the book, or the final chapter, at least, you know, on how to democratize the Fed through legislation and a constitutional amendment, and how that would work. All right. It's also a myth that the Fed raises and lowers rates to counter inflation. You know, this 2% inflation target is also a myth, right? It's about subsidizing the banks when they get in trouble, right? And it's about paying for the deficit and the debt. That's what the real objectives of the central bank are, bailing out the banks when they get in trouble periodically, which they do, right? So the reality is the central bank is there to protect the banks, bail them out, subsidize them, and to pay for deficits through bond issuance on behalf of the Treasury. Okay. Again, read some of the articles I've posted, I've written in the World Financial Review and European Financial Review on that topic. All right, one more comment here on the global oil situation. Global oil, we've been talking about that, right? We talked about why global oil prices, a financial asset, have been declining. They seem to have leveled off here this past week as news of a deal of production cuts between OPEC and Russia emerged. Oil prices had collapsed 30%. And that, according to the deal, OPEC, led by Saudi Arabia, of course, will cut its daily production of oil by 800,000 barrels, and Russia and the rest of OPEC by another 400,000. So 1.2 million barrels a day cut. Well, you reduce the supply, supposedly, you know, your price will go up, and it will shore up the decline in oil price, oil prices. Well, U.S. shale producers, the third big player here, are projecting to increase in 2019 their output by 1.2 million barrels a day. In other words, the OPEC-Russia deal simply offsets the projected increase by shale producers in the U.S. from 10.88 million a day to 12.06 million barrels a day. And in fact, in recent months, the Saudis have continued, and the UAE, United Arab Emirates, has continued to increase their output of oil. The deal with Russia doesn't start till January, so they're, you know, jumping the gun here, getting as much out there as they can. Right, Saudis and UAE. And we'll see what happens this coming year. You know, this oil price collapse over the summer was really caused by the Saudis, you know, and the U.S. putting sanctions on Iran and Venezuela. The whole idea was to reduce through sanctions the output of oil by Iran and Venezuela, and then the Saudis thought they would capture all that reduction, and they lowered their price to gain that market share. In other words, you know, this Iran sanctions is about oil in large part. It's about squeezing those countries, Iran and Venezuela, so that Saudi Arabia can grab their share of oil, right? At least Iran and U.S. shale producers grab Venezuela oil share to the U.S. You know, it's about oil. That's what these sanctions are about, in large part. Not totally, but in large part. Well, the Saudis, you know, increased their output, but the Iranians got around and the Venezuelans got around the sanctions, right? And their oil output did not appreciably decline. Europe kept buying Iranian oil, and so forth. The sanctions did not really cut very deeply, and so we ended up with a massive excess of oil. So the Saudis and Trump created the problem of oil price collapse here, right? That now this so-called Russian OPEC Saudi deal is designed to correct. But the wild cards, U.S. shale producers, are increasing their output nonetheless. And I predict the Russian OPEC deal will be circumvented, and we will see a breakdown of that deal, especially as the global economy slows next year. Okay, China trade war. Some updates here on China, and then we'll get right into Europe. China trade war. Well, we've seen the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, where Trump met with China President Xi, and Trump comes out of that claiming that, he won big concessions from the Chinese. Yeah. Well, China simply put, as I've said last week, put back on the table its offers to buy more U.S. farm goods, and to give U.S. companies and bankers more access to China. That wasn't new. But Trump made concessions of his own. He agreed not to raise tariffs from 10% to 25% come January 1st, and not to impose another $267 billion in tariffs on China, the rest of all Chinese goods. And it was agreed 90-day hiatus here. Right. But he put Robert Lighthizer, U.S. anti-China hardliner, in charge of negotiations with the Chinese over the next 90 days. And what have we seen here this past week? Well, China continues to make overtures of concessions. They've started buying soybeans again. They've talked about rolling back tariffs on U.S. autos. Exports to China from 40% to the original 15% that existed last summer. They've sent out directives to their agencies indicating trying to do something about intellectual property, which is an issue here in the negotiations. And they've even signaled they might do something about their tech transfer, tech development, the China 2025 policy, in which they want to be leaders in next generation technology by 2025, they were open to discussing that with the U.S. So China is playing it cool, giving signals, but the U.S. is playing hardball still. Well, we saw last week the Huawei, China Telecom, big China Telecom company. One of the leading companies that will drive China's 2025 tech policy, Huawei. Huawei's co-chairperson happened to go to Canada, Meng Zhou something, right? And the Canadians, at the request of the U.S., arrested her, allegedly on something to do with selling to Iran in violation of the U.S. sanctions on Iran. They've arrested her. Yeah, created quite a stir. Well, they since let her out on bail because China has responded by arresting two Canadian diplomats or ex-diplomats. Okay, tit for tat, right? Why Canada is playing this game on behalf of the U.S. is interesting. Why they're risking their trade relations with China is interesting. I wonder what's really behind this, Some kind of deal with the U.S. has to be involved here. We'll find out. And Trump comes out last week and says that oh, that's okay to arrest this person, but we'll trade her off, you know, for concessions, China. Well, think about this, you know. I mean, they apparently arrested her because of a matter of law violation and sanctions. If Trump is simply going to trade that off, what does that mean for the legality of U.S. sanctions? Or the whole question of law. Can the president of the United States simply contravene the law? Is Trump above the law that he can simply decide, oh, the law doesn't apply, I'm going to manipulate and use the law for other objectives I have, I'm going to let people off the hook, and well, you know, undermines the rule of law, doesn't it? Well, Trump always believed he was above the law, and he's going to, of course, if he's impeached, he's going to pardon himself. You know, that's a tyrant. If you're above the law, that's a tyrant. If you rule by dictate, that's a tyrant. And, of course, Trump has very strong tyrannical leanings in how he does business and how he governs, which is the same thing. You see, how he governs is how he did his business. The U.S. has apparently also gotten other allies to attack Huawei. The U.K., Japan have joined in and indicated, well, we're going to look at Huawei and stop them. This is all part of the global fight between the U.S. and its allies over technology, next generation technology. China, most recently here, ruled against Apple Corp, in Apple's dispute with the other U.S. company called Qualcomm over chips, you see, and ruled that Qualcomm in China should prevail over Apple in their dispute. Well, that was interesting. That's a tit-for-tat counter here. You know, and then Apple announces, oh, we're going to build more plants in Austin, Texas. Well, we're going to see more company-to-company fights. You know, the fight is going to be at the company level as negotiations go on here for the next 90 days. And if necessary, I think they'll be extended. Oh, on this, parenthetically here, on this auto tariff rollback by China, it's interesting. It's come out that it doesn't really affect U.S. auto companies. It affects German auto companies producing autos in the U.S., you see. Ford, GM, and now Tesla already produce in China. They don't export to China very much. So the tariffs don't have much effect on them, but they have an effect on German auto producers, Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen, who produce in the U.S. and then export to China. Well, the German auto companies met with Trump about a week ago. What was that all about? Yeah, well, now we know what it was about, right? And they will benefit now, because the German auto companies were saying to Trump, look, you know, if these Chinese tariffs remain at 40%, we have no alternative but to scale back our production plants in the U.S. and move them to China. That would have been a lot of layoffs in Alabama and South Carolina and Tennessee. So, I don't know. Did Trump make a concession quietly in exchange for the rollback and the auto tariffs, or did the Chinese just sort of cleverly know that game? Okay, so that's the China trade war. All right, let's move on to Europe, the sick man of Europe, right? What are the dimensions of Europe? Europe is, well, Japan's pretty bad off too, pretty stagnant, but Europe just can't get going. It can't get really recovery. It's locked in this long-term epic recession, stagnation, weak recovery, short, followed by stagnation and recessions. And it's also in already near recession again at 0.2% growth rate in the third quarter, and facing big problems here with the Brexit issue comes to a head in March with the Italian populists, which are refusing to go by the budget limit rule, the austerity rule. Problems in German banks, and of course now the eruption in France. Okay, Europe is more dependent on global exports for its growth than is the U.S. And Germany, the engine of Europe, especially dependent on exports. Roughly half of German GDP is from exports, either to other countries in the Eurozone or globally. Right? Okay, so as the global economy slows, Europe really slows. And Europe's banking system is in trouble. It does not have what we call capital markets, non-bank sources, bonds, shadow banks, and so forth, to borrow money from. So if the banks are in trouble, it really slows down the economy. And the European Central Bank policy has been subsidizing European banks, but they've been sending their money offshore or to the U.S. So that's a problem. You see, they can't get it going. And the European Central Bank started providing free money in 2012 in significant proportions. And that has driven, that drove down interest rates to zero and even negative rates in Europe. But it really hasn't stimulated the recovery because it hasn't stimulated real investment, which is even greater testimony that monetary policy cannot generate sustained, robust economic recovery. But the banks like it that way, you see, because they get the money first and they decide whether they're going to invest it or not. That's quite different than fiscal policy, in which you provided money to households who spent it, and then businesses borrowed from the banks to expand and meet the demand. That's quite different. That's bottom up, you see. Monetary policy is top down. But the bankers love it that way. And of course, the bank has been driving U.S. policy ever since 2008. Bailed them out, and we continued with low rates. Well, low rates continued even lower in Europe. But that free money has distorted European bond markets. And in Europe, the ECB has been buying corporate bonds, so it's distorted those bond markets. Hasn't really generated recovery. So the second element of the strategy Europe has been following is what's called internal devaluations. In other words, if countries cannot lower the value of their currency to generate more exports competitively, because the euro is set by a central bank dominated by Germany and its friends, okay, then the only other way to make your exports more competitive is to reduce your costs directly, not from lower interest rate cost, but or devaluation cost, right? But by reducing wages. You see, that's the other element of this strategy in Europe that often isn't talked about. Drive down wages, real wages, and therefore make the cost of your goods less expensive than your competitors worldwide and generate GDP growth through internal devaluation. You're not devaluing your currency. That's external devaluation. You're devaluing it by the cost of production. Well, labor market reforms is the code word throughout Europe has been for doing just this. And in Spain, they did it quite successfully. They drove down wage costs, and that boosted their exports, and they got a recovery out of it. Well, you know, in Italy, they're trying to do the same. They did it, of course, in Greece. They've been trying to do it in Italy without any success, labor market reforms. They finally passed it through labor market reforms under the socialist president Hollande, and then even deeper under the banker Macron, who is now president since he got in office a couple years ago, right? That's what labor market reforms are, drive down wages. In other words, get rid of deferred wages, reduce pensions, that's deferred wage payments, reduce minimum wages, make big changes to collective bargaining and union rights and worker rights, which prevents them from getting wage increases, promise that you're going to do something about contingent labor, which is about underemployed at lower wages and no benefits. You see, since 2012, 67-80% of all the hiring in Europe has been contingent. In other words, low wage part-time temp work. U.S., most of our recovery has been that as well, contingent labor. That's why wages aren't rising, contrary to what they say. And in Europe, it's been even more intense. And you still got 10% unemployment in Europe. So what you got in France now with the yellow vests is just the spontaneous protest against these conditions, and was provoked by making it even worse for average folks by raising taxes, which was necessary to offset the big tax cuts that Macron gave to the rich. Sound familiar? Sure. Well, that was the last straw. And French workers have hit the streets, and small businesses with them, right? And self-employed with them in protest against this internal devaluation, which drives down their standard of living, drives down their wages, designed to increase the competitiveness of French exports. Try to replicate the Spanish deal, for example. Now, this is all accompanied by fiscal austerity, which is driven by a limit of how much, in the Eurozone, how much countries can spend on social programs and infrastructure and so forth, no more than 3.5% of the deficit. Well, they've reached the max on that. And what you've got is a protest going on in Italy. The five-star movement, the populists, say we're going to bust this 3.5% rule. We're going to spend more to stimulate the economy. In other words, we're going to throw out at least part of this fiscal austerity. The Greeks tried to do that, but they were so small, you know, they got squashed. And they couldn't pull it off. Italy may pull it off. So you got this problem in Italy, the five-star movement challenging austerity. You got the problem in France of the populace challenging internal devaluations. And now you got the ECB saying, well, we're going to raise interest rates. Now, just like the U.S., right? We're going to stop buying tens of billions of dollars of bonds every month. That's quantitative easing in France, in Europe, right? So the whole strategy is beginning to break down. You know, the whole Europe capitalist strategy based on QE, based on internal devaluation, based on fiscal austerity is fragmenting and fracturing everywhere. And on top of that, you got Brexit, you see. Brexit represents, and the attempt by northeast there in Spain, Barcelona, I forget the name of the region there, you know, the separatism trends occurring, our response to this as well. The elites, local elites there, and similarly in the case of the UK, believe that the problem is to get out of the Eurozone so that they can engage in their own currency devaluations to stimulate their economy. That's what that is about. And that's what Brexit is about. Brexit, you know, the UK, as long as it fails to exit and it keeps putting it off, the UK economy will get weaker and weaker. You know, it's supposed to come to a head March 29th. I don't think it will. I don't think there'll be a hard Brexit. They'll just kick the can down the road more and more till next year or the end of next year, right? That's what the Europeans do. They kick the can down the road. So, you know, Brexit and separatism and immigration issues are overlaid by internal devaluations, are overlaid by fiscal austerity, and that means Europe is not going to recover. By the way, the European Central Bank says it's going to not continue buying bonds, new bonds. I think it's like $30 billion a month or something like that. Well, is this the end of QE? No. because they are saying they're going to continue to roll over the bonds they've already bought when they mature. And they're going to continue to buy bonds. They're not. They're just not going to add to the 2.6 trillion euros that the ECB has on its balance sheet. And when the next crisis comes, which it will, Europe will be at the center of it, no doubt, being one of the weakest links in the global capitalist economy. You know, they have no tools except to buy more, bail out the banks by buying even more. They have no tools, monetary, and of course, the whole idea is to prevent fiscal tools, government spending, in order to generate some sort of recovery. So fiscal monetary policy is hitting a wall, in other words. You know, and that's why we see more direct subsidization of capitalist businesses, particularly finance, by the political elites, the state, in these economies. European banks are also in trouble. Very large non-performing bank loan overlay. Deutsche Bank's in trouble, probably will be forced merged with Commerce Bank. The Italian banks are all in trouble, UniCredit and so forth. Now we're seeing Credit Suisse in trouble here. UK banks, who knows what's going to happen if a Brexit. And the Greek and the Portuguese banks are also showing stress once again. So very weak bank system, financial system, that will play a role here when we hit the next crisis. If this fiscal rule 3.5% is successfully unraveled by Italy, and now France is breaking that, Macron is making concessions, breaking that rule as well. How are they going to run policy in Europe if they have no fiscal austerity? How are they going to make this monetary policy work, which is breaking down as well? Okay. So the ECB is really continuing to roll over its 2.6 trillion. It's not really backed out. We're going to have a new chair. Mario Draghi is leaving soon, and a new chair of the ECB, and it'll be interesting to see. But, you know, all these central banks, other major central banks, are to some extent just the followers of the Fed. You know, their policies are all in response to the Federal Reserve changes. And the Federal Reserve, of course, is raising rates, but won't be able to much further. So if it stops raising rates, the Europeans and the Japanese can hold off their QEs in raising rates in turn, you see. So the U.S. controls, runs the global economy through a number of means, one of which is control of its currency, the global currency. Another is through monetary policy, influencing through the Federal Reserve, sanctions now, renegotiating trade rules and relationships. These are all how the U.S. Controls the global capitalist economy. But it's getting more and more difficult for the U.S., right? And we'll be talking about that next week as well. And next week, I'm gonna do a review of capitalist elites' warnings of trouble coming here. You know, Dalio and Jacob and Yellen and others. Okay, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Vision.